Welcome to Oncology Today, Current and Future Management of Extrapulmonary Neuroendocrine Carcinoma. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. Jonathan Strasberg from the Moffitt Cancer Center in Tampa, Florida, to discuss the treatment of extrapulmonary neuroendocrine carcinomas, or NECs. Conflict of interest statements for the faculty can be found in the program notes. The use of agents and treatments that are not approved may be discussed in this program, so check out the package insert information for more. To begin, I asked Dr. Strasberg to provide an overview of the incidence and clinical presentation of extrapulmonary NECs.
When we talk about extrapulmonary neuroendocrine cancer, it's relatively uncommon. So approximately 10% of neuroendocrine carcinomas are extrapulmonary. The large majority, about 90%, are small cell lung cancer. I'm not actually sure about the exact numbers. I would guesstimate that the number of extrapulmonary neuroendocrine carcinomas is probably 1 to 2 per 100,000 in terms of incidence. It's clearly a minority, both if you look at extrapulmonary versus pulmonary, and also if you look at extrapulmonary neuroendocrine carcinoma versus well-differentiated neuroendocrine tumor. We see many more neuroendocrine tumors than neuroendocrine carcinomas in the GI tract. Now, in the GU tract, which is quite rare, you almost never see well-differentiated neuroendocrine tumors. It's all neuroendocrine carcinomas.
And can you talk a little bit about the typical clinical presentation in this situation with this tumor?
Sure. Patients present similarly to any other type of aggressive cancer, except it tends to be faster growing than usual. So some, onset of symptoms tends to be faster. So most patients have metastatic disease in diagnosis and develop symptoms related to metastases, such as, pain, weight loss, decline in performance status, fatigue. But of course, you can get symptoms related to the primary tumor as well. So dysphagia, in the case of esophageal neuroendocrine carcinoma, rectal bleeding or rectal pain in the case of anorectal neuroendocrine carcinoma. Liver metastases are quite common in this disease. So jaundice, right upper quadrant pain, early satiety. So these are sort of the symptoms that you would expect. For genitourinary, of course, cervical neuroendocrine cancers, patients will sometimes develop vaginal bleeding, vaginal pain, discharge.
So people, of course, think a lot about small cell in this situation. How does the growth rate in response to the chemotherapy compare? In small cell, you see very high growth fractions and responsiveness to chemotherapy. What about an extrapulmonary disease? And also, what about brain mets, which, of course, is a very important part of small cell of the lung?
Right. So the growth rate and response to chemotherapy are fairly similar in extrapulmonary neuroendocrine carcinoma versus small cell lung cancer, although I think it's probably a little bit lower on average, the response rate to chemotherapy. And it may depend a little bit on the primary site. For example, poorly differentiated neuroendocrine carcinoma tends to be associated with a particularly poor prognosis. The question about brain mets is a very good one. Brain mets are relatively common in this disease, but less common than with small cell lung cancer. And I'm talking here particularly below the diaphragm. So if you happen to have a small cell originating somewhere in the head and neck, I would probably recommend getting a brain MRI at baseline, although, we don't have much data. Those are extremely rare. Below the diaphragm, there's some controversy about this. I think most people don't necessarily get a routine brain imaging, but we tell patients to let us know if any hint of headaches or neurologic symptoms, because we want a low threshold to image the brain.
How about paraneoplastic syndromes?
It's fairly uncommon. Sometimes we'll see Cushing syndrome, sometimes hypercalcemia, SIDH, very rarely. So I would say probably less common than in small cell on average.
So you also brought up the issue of transitioning or transformation in prostate cancer into a neuroendocrine tumor, something that you know, people are concerned about in terms of making sure they get histology when people progress. But also we see this in lung cancer. I guess where I've heard about it most has been with EGFR mutant lung cancer. I don't know if it maybe occurs in other non-small cell lung cancer that turn into these undifferentiated neuroendocrine tumors. Any comments in terms of how these, I guess you'd say, secondary neuroendocrine tumors respond to treatment, and also like what's going on there pathologically?
Yeah, that's a good question. I've heard of this phenomenon in EGFR positive non-small cell lung cancer. There's probably a selective pressure, and similarly in prostate cancer, under the pressure of hormone suppression, there may be a pressure for a particular phenotype to develop. You know, as far as treatment, we treat them similarly to de novo, poorly differentiated NEC.
You also brought up the issue of diagnosis, and I'm curious, is the diagnosis usually very obvious histologically? You brought up a lot of mutational profiles. Are there times when the diagnosis is not clear-cut from histology?
Absolutely. So there's two different diagnostic challenges, I would say. The first is distinguishing a poorly differentiated neuroendocrine carcinoma from well-differentiated high-grade neuroendocrine tumor. And sometimes, usually it's pretty obvious. You know, morphologically, neuroendocrine carcinomas are arrayed as sheets, very high levels of necrosis. Pleomorphism, well-differentiated neuroendocrine tumors are classically arranged in islets or trabeculae. They have the typical salt and pepper chromatin, relatively monomorphic. So, you know, in classic cases, there's not a lot of overlap, but we do see gray areas, and that's typically we're talking about needle biopsy and patients who have a Ki-67 of 40-50%, and there's some pleomorphism and you know, high nuclear to cytoplasmic ratio, more than you'd expect from well differentiated, and the pathologist just can't say whether it's well differentiated or poorly differentiated. So that's one type of pathological dilemma. The other is trying to distinguish neuroendocrine carcinoma from, say, an adenocarcinoma or just a poorly differentiated carcinoma of unknown type. And that's actually quite common. In many cases, the pathology will start out as carcinoma with neuroendocrine features, and then a pathologist will say, no, this really is a poorly differentiated neuroendocrine carcinoma. But this concept of carcinoma with neuroendocrine features is really not that uncommon. And because, you know, many, you know, adenocarcinomas will express, for example, synaptophysin to some extent or other neuroendocrine markers. In fact, I saw a patient recently who started out with a diagnosis of poorly differentiated neuroendocrine cancer. And then at our institution, the diagnosis was adjusted to MINN, in other words, mixed neuroendocrine, non-neuroendocrine. And then at some point, she was rebiopsied, and the rebiopsy was completely adenocarcinoma. And so these things can be diagnostically unclear and changed over time.
And what was the primary?
I believe it was colon.
That's a pretty big difference in treatment.
Right. And so we're moving towards thinking that it may be best to actually treat these patients like the primary site of origin. So, for example, I saw a patient very recently with primary gallbladder neuroendocrine carcinoma with next-generation sequencing showing HER2 amplification, which, of course, is not uncommon in gallbladder adenocarcinoma, which, again, illustrates the fact that These tumors do share a lot of similarities with the adenocarcinomas of the same primary site. And so it probably makes more sense in this patient, at least for second-line therapy, to target HER2 as you would do for gallbladder cancer.
Not to mention there are two alternatives there. You've got the bispecific zanidatamab and the ADC, HER2 ADC, TDXD there. So, a big practical difference in terms of what a patient might be eligible for. Let's get into a little bit more about the management of these patients. And maybe we can just start out with localized disease. I mean, like small cell, I know it's very uncommon, but any cases come to mind where you had patients like that? And how do you think through their management? Do you go to surgery, for example?
Yes. So the only thing we can say for sure is that these patients should get chemotherapy because, again, this is a disease that that tends to relapse very quickly. Probably makes most sense in most cases to administer chemotherapy neoadjuvantly because of the high risk of micrometastases developing and growing quickly. And then, you know, depending on the primary site, we'll consider surgery or radiation or both, and also depending on whether it's truly local or local regional. So if it's, for example, right colon, I think we'd be more likely to treat with surgery after neoadjuvant chemotherapy. If it's, you know, distal rectum, I saw a patient recently, and we made the decision to do definitive chemo radiation rather than APR. Mentioned esophageal, there is some data suggesting that surgery is probably not beneficial and that most patients should be treated with definitive chemo radiation. Interestingly, we saw a patient recently with a primary colon but microsatellite unstable, and we administered the neoadjuvant immunotherapy just a few cycles like you would for adenocarcinoma under the same circumstances, and she had then proceeded with surgery and had a complete pathological response.
Wow. This was a neck?
It was, yeah.
Has that been reported? I was going to ask you, but I figured probably it wouldn't be. It seems like if it was MSI high, it kind of seems like it's more rectal, but can you see MSI high, poorly differentiated or undifferentiated neck?
Well, apparently you can, at least assuming the pathologists were correct on the colonoscopy biopsy specimen. There was nothing left on the surgical specimen.
That's really fascinating. What about local therapy in patients with metastatic disease, oligometastatic disease? Is that a strategy you ever use in this disease, or is it too aggressive?
So if you're thinking like liver therapy for liver dominant disease, I mean, very rare. Sometimes we'll do things like radioembolization, but I can't think of too many cases where patients have really benefited from that significantly.
So can you talk about the typical approach to these patients with first-line therapy, what we know about that?
Yeah, so the standard first-line therapy is platinum etoposide. I usually prefer carboplatin to cisplatin just for tolerability reasons. I do talk to some patients about FOLFIRINOX instead of platinum etoposide, especially if they're fit, especially with primary sites where we would normally consider FOLFIRINOX, such as pancreas or colorectal. Most cases it's platinum etoposide, and if they have more than 3 to 6 months of benefit, and I would say I would lean more to 6 months than 3 months, we can consider repeating the same regimen. Or, for example, if they start with platinum etoposide and they're still fit, usually we'll talk about FOLFIRINOX as the next step. In some cases, we do combination immunotherapy, either second or third line. So typically ipilimumab and nivolumab.
Do patients typically respond, you know, similar to what happens with small cell?
To repeat to second line chemotherapy?
No, to first line.
Oh, yeah. A little bit less on average in small cell, and it may differ a little bit according to primary site. I'd say about half the patients have a significant response.
And again, thinking about small cell, we see it had been often used second line, now maybe going to be moved on to maintenance, which is lurbinectinib. Has that been looked at here?
Not really. I'm not aware of actually any published data on lurbinectinib. I have personally tried it in some patients without seeing response, but I don't believe there's been any prospective data. I might be wrong about that.
And then, of course, the question is, and now we have IOs, immunotherapy, first line, extensive stage, and limited stage for that matter, in small cell. Where are we right now in understanding the impact, if any, of checkpoint inhibitors in neuroendocrine tumors?
So we don't have any good quality data yet in the first line. There is a SWOG study looking at platinum etoposide plus minus atezo in extrapulmonary neck. I think the study is about halfway enrolled, although it's been quite a few years that it's been open. So it's a hard population to study. In the second line and beyond, there have been several studies, and I'd say for most, the response rate has been less than 20%, and durable response rate is probably less than 10%. But, you know, very rarely we'll see an extraordinary durable response. So it can work extraordinarily well in a very small percentage of patients.
Is that something that you attempt to obtain for a patient at any point, a second line or beyond, outside a trial setting?
I'd say if patients are fit and there's no other good option, which is unfortunately the case for many patients beyond first line, I will try to recommend immunotherapy, and I usually go with combination. And here I'm talking, of course, about patients who don't have a high tumor mutation burden or microsatellite insufficiency. If they do, then clearly they should be getting these drugs. But in unselected patients, I still try to prescribe, and in most cases it is covered, if not by insurance, then by the manufacturer.
I mean, in a way, if you think about it, in small cell, it's not exactly a home run. There's no predictors that I know about that really helps you decide who might benefit more. And, you see a benefit there for sure, but it's not gigantic. I would imagine if you have a lot fewer patients to look at, it might be harder to see the benefit.
Yeah, the randomized trial that I've been talking about is not a very large trial, and I'm not sure it's sufficiently powered to show the kind of minimal benefit that you'd expect from small cell lung cancer.
So you mentioned a little bit about second-line options. What about other forms of targeted therapy? You referred to use the fact that some of these people have BRAF mutations. Does BRAF targeted therapy work? Any other targets that are effective in extrapulmonary neck?
It's very rare to see actionable mutations. I mean, clearly, if you see something like NTRK or RET, I would recommend using a drug that targets that. But that's very uncommon.
So let's talk a little bit about DLL3 and particularly these bispecifics that are coming out that are so exciting. First of all, can you explain a little bit about what DLL3 is? And you also referred back to the history there with Rova-T, the ADC that didn't seem to pan out. But again, unfortunately, a lot of toxicity there. So I don't know if that means that ADC wouldn't work. But can you talk a little bit about DLL3 and what it is?
Sure. It's an inhibitory component of the Notch pathway, typically expressed intracellularly, but in certain cancers, highly expressed on the cell surface. And that seems to be the case mostly for poorly differentiated neuroendocrine carcinomas, including small cell and extrapulmonary neuroendocrine carcinoma. And as far as the bispecifics, we know that it's an effective therapy based on the experience with tarlatamab in small cell lung cancer, where response rates were fairly high, where both PFS and overall survival were improved with the drug, and preliminary data in EP neck that is highly expressive of somatostatin receptors, particularly obrixtamib, which was associated with a response rate of 40% in patients that expressed DLL3 in more than 50% of cells. So definitely signs of activity and manageable toxicity, it seems.
And it was interesting when you went through the obrixtamib data that they actually broke it out based, I guess, on a high and low expression of DLL3. And I noticed also, I think it was only 60 out of 200 that actually had DLL3. And of those, half were high expressors. Did I see that right?
Yeah, I'm not sure if the screen failure rate was entirely based on DLL3 expression. It might have been various other factors involved, but only 60 patients enrolled. I'm sure there were a lot of dropouts for other reasons.
Oh, I see. Because I don't remember seeing DLL3 levels with tarlatamab, or did I miss that?
Right. I'm not sure that in small cell cancer that was considered an eligibility criteria. I think the expression of DLL3 in small cell is considered higher on average. Now, it may be that it should be a predictive factor, but I'm not aware of the data on that.
And is the assay for DLL3 pretty straightforward? Is it IHC?
It is IHC, yeah.
And how do they grade it? Just positive or negative, or like 4+? Or?
I think there's something like the Allred score for grading it, but I don't have any personal experience yet. The eligibility was based on percentage of cells staining. I'm not sure it was based on intensity of staining.
Anyhow, can you talk a little bit more about what was seen with obrixtamab, particularly when I first heard about tarlatamab? Of course, we have a lot of experience with CD3 bispecifics in myeloma and lymphoma. And, of course, we've been hearing about cytokine release and ICANS there, as well as with CAR-T. When I started thinking about it, first in small cell and now extrapulmonary neck, I was wondering how that would play out. What do we know, though, about the efficacy of obrixtamab, both in the high expressors and the low expressors, as well as toxicity?
Right. So the phase one study with expansion had 60 patients that were divided equally into high expressors and low expressors, and the response rate in the high expressors was 40%, some of which were durable. As far as toxicity, the rate of CRS was quite high, but almost all grade 1 and 2. The rate of ICANS, I believe, was less than 20%, and only about a third of those were grade 3 or higher. So these are definitely issues. On the study, the first couple of doses are administered on an inpatient basis with a 24-hour period of observation, but then afterwards the plan is for it to be outpatient.
And what do we see in terms of efficacy? It looked like it had a pretty interesting waterfall plot there.
Yeah, both the waterfall plot, which showed a response rate of 40%, and the swimmer plot showing that I think about a third of the patients on the DLL3 high group had fairly durable responses. So I think the median duration of response was nearly 8 months. There were a couple of patients that went well beyond that.
Any other bispecific similar to obrixtamab being studied, and is the thought to move it up theoretically earlier in terms of first-line therapy?
Yeah, so if I'm not mistaken, the trispecific engager, which in addition to DLL3 and CD3, also binds to albumin to increase the half-life. I'm not 100% sure about that. That's another one that I'm aware of.
You mentioned the Darien 5 study that's being done with obrixtamab. Can you talk about what they're going to look at there?
Sure. It's looking at several doses of obrixtamib. It's a single-arm study. I believe the primary endpoint is objective response rate, and they'll be, as of a new amendment, they'll be looking at Only extrapulmonary. Now I recall it started out, you were asking about a brixtamib and small cell lung cancer. It actually started out as a combination of small cell and extrapulmonary, extrapulmonary neck, but there's an expansion cohort that we're participating in that is exclusively extrapulmonary. And I believe the plan is to accrue 50 patients.
But it's also being looked at in small cell?
Yeah.
That's what I thought, yeah. Any differences that you can see at this point between tarlatamab and brixtamab?
I mean, they target the same receptors. I don't know if there's any basis to differentiate them, at least not that I'm aware of.
So you talked about a number of other new agents or strategies being looked at, one being LBL-024, bispecific antibody targeting PD-L1 and co-stimulatory activating T cells, B1BB.
Yep.
CD137.
Right. So, you know, there's nothing about that that's specific to neuroendocrine carcinomas. This is a strategy that potentially could work, I think, for many cancers, because it's simply a way of bringing lymphocytes in close proximity to PD-L1 expressing tumors. But it seems, you know, the data presented at ASCO last year were quite encouraging in the first line in combination with platinum etoposide. But of course, you know, it's always hard to judge when you're combining a novel agent with chemotherapy.
What about ABBV-001 that targets SEZ6 and ADC and any other ADCs that are being looked at?
So that's a particular target that's highly expressed in neuroendocrine carcinomas, and the preliminary results from this study really looked quite exciting. So I hope that that it moves on to randomized clinical studies. I'm not aware of any other ADCs. I'm sure there are other targeted drugs that are being studied right now, but I'm not aware of any.
All right, let's talk about your cases. These are actual patients you took care of?
Mm-hmm, yep.
So when did you first meet this 56-year-old woman, and what happened with her?
So she presented 3 years ago with abdominal pain and bloating. CT showed numerous tumors in the liver, retroperitoneal adenopathy. FDG PET was avid. It was actually a known primary. Confirmed on colonoscopy, actually, that there was no primary in the colon, as you would expect with this history. So liver biopsy revealed poorly differentiated neuroendocrine carcinoma. This was actually a case where one pathologist felt it was carcinoma with neuroendocrine features, and another said, you know, more definitively, poorly differentiated neck. Positive for synaptophysin, but negative for chromogranin, which is not unusual with poorly differentiated neuroendocrine carcinomas. CDX2 focally positive, so probably a GI primary somewhere. And Ki67 was 90%. Next generation sequencing showed mutations in P53 and CCNE1. TMB was low. So this patient began carboetoposide, had a partial response, continued treatment for approximately 4 months with a very good partial response at the conclusion of that. But she progressed several months later. Again, not unusual. She began FOLFIRINOX and had a near CR. And then stopped oxaliplatin 6 months after starting due to neuropathy. Continued on maintenance FOLFIRI. And then stopped irinotecan a few months ago. Continued on 5-FU. But progressed relatively quickly. Also had very mild headaches and had a MRI of the brain showing a cerebellar metastasis, which was treated with SBRT and then resumed FOLFIRINOX. So, you know, I'm not presenting the worst cases. This is an atypically good outcome case when you think of the, you know, disease stage and tumor burden to presentation. better than average outcomes in this case. And what it illustrates is that FOLFIRINOX can be appropriate for metastatic neck of GI primary, or in this case, suspected GI primary, and also low threshold for brain imaging, if anything suggestive of brain metastases.
What's her current status?
Well, just resumed FOLFIRINOX and feeling well, so hopefully we'll be able to tolerate this regimen.
What would you be thinking about if she does have disease progression and is eligible to be treated? Any of the newer therapies that we've talked about would be of interest if you could access them, or any clinical trials?
I'm actually planning on doing DLL3 staining as soon as we open the DARIN5 obrixtamib trial, which should be any day now.
So you're thinking that she might be a candidate for that study?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
How do you think that would sit with her?
I suspect she would be interested in anything that offers the potential for benefit. I mean, she would have to progress again. I think there's a reasonable chance of having a second remission with FOLFIRINOX, but if it's not tolerable or doesn't work, it's good to have another option available.
When you think about giving obrixtamab to a patient, any, I wouldn't say contraindications or relative contraindications, anything that would give you reason to think twice about it? I know when we've talked about tarlatamab in small cell, people get a little bit nervous about giving it to people who've had brain mets or brain irradiation because of the potential to confuse with ICANS or maybe make ICANS more likely. Any thoughts about any type of, you know, situation would get you to think twice about a bispecific like obrixtamab?
So the study does allow controlled CNS metastases. There is some exclusion involving autoimmune diseases, and this patient has a history of ulcerative colitis, but has not required any therapy for that recently. So I think that should not be is not an absolute contraindication.
All right, let's hear about your 63-year-old man.
Yeah, so this is another positive case. It's always nicer to present the good outcomes rather than the patient that comes in and with a performance status of 3 and is not a candidate to even start treatment. So this is a 63-year-old man who presented 5 years ago with abdominal pain, dysphagia, and fatigue. CT demonstrated pericaval and periportal lymphadenopathy. FDG PET showed hypermetabolic uptake in the distal esophagus and diffuse abdominal retroperitoneal lymphadenopathy. Needle biopsy of retroperitoneal lymph node showed poorly differentiated neck. Again, synaptophysin positive, chromogranin negative. And the NGS was pretty unremarkable. Low TMB, P53 mutation, and loss of several other genes. So this patient began chemotherapy with carboplatin etoposide, progressed very quickly through this, declining ECOG performance status, started immunotherapy with ipilimumab nivolumab, and had a radiographic CR and resolution of symptoms. So this is probably the best response I've seen to immunotherapy in a patient that doesn't have good predictive factors. At some point, he developed diarrhea with evidence of colitis, which improved after prednisone taper, and moved on to nivolumab monotherapy, stopped after 2 years, and remains in complete remission.
I wasn't expecting that.
So again, not a typical case, but the conclusion is response to immune checkpoint inhibitors are real but rare. Durable PR, in this case CR, observed in less than 10% of cases. But we need new immunotherapy strategies because this is really a needle in the haystack, as they say.
If you had to hypothesize or even make a wild guess, any idea why somebody would have such a great response and many others would not?
I think he was expressing some new antigen that immunotherapy latched onto. But other than that, I don't have a particular hypothesis. I mean, there was the TMB was low. I don't think we checked PD-L1 expression, but that hasn't really been shown to be a predictive marker.
So you say he got treatment for 2 years with the combination, or you stopped the IPI after a while?
We usually stop the IPI after four cycles. And in this case, around that time, the patient developed autoimmune colitis. So after treating the colitis, we just proceeded with nivolumab.
But you continued the nivolumab even after the colitis. That's interesting.
Yes. Yeah.
And no more problems.
Correct. Yeah.
So you stopped the nivolumab after 2 years?
Yeah. So I did have a conversation after the colitis, I talked to several people with a lot of experience in immunotherapy, and they felt that it was reasonable to give it a try. And after 2 years, I think it's pretty standard to stop immunotherapy at that point.
I've heard people talk about using cell-free DNA in that situation. I don't know how often it would be positive, but any thoughts about that? And is cell-free DNA ever utilized in the extrapulmonary neck in any of these studies that you've been talking about?
It's not used conventionally. I mean, increasingly we're seeing patients who, are undergoing Signatera testing. And I suppose it's something that we could incorporate into our practice. I'm not sure to what extent it adds information for the average patient, but this is really no different from most other cancers where it's becoming more routine.
So maybe we could just spend a couple minutes here just to finish out with a quick update on management of well-differentiated necks. So we talked about that, of course, when you were here in Miami, but can you talk about maybe some of the things that happened at ASCO or anything new that you think would be worth commenting on?
Well, since Miami, which was, I believe, in January, I probably talked about cabozantinib, but it has been approved since then. It was approved in March. So that's a new option for patients with metastatic, well-differentiated neuroendocrine tumors, both originating in the gastrointestinal tract, pancreas, as well as lung and thymus, where cabozantinib should be sequenced and are already complicated. Sequencing algorithm is hard to say. On the cabinet study, all patients had received at least one line of therapy beyond somatostatin analog, and in many cases, multiple lines of therapy. It's always hard to know where cabozantinib should be sequenced.
And generally speaking, where do you think about using it?
Still start with a somatostatin analog for most patients that express somatostatin receptors. We probably use most commonly lutetium dotatate as a second-line systemic treatment. We still do a lot of liver-directed therapy. For pancreas, we tend to use also capecitabine temozolomide in the second or third line. I would say cabozantinib is quite similar to sunitinib. It may be slightly more effective. These drugs have not been compared to each other, but the hazard ratios are looking a little bit better than sunitinib. Whether to use it early than everolimus is hard to say. It may be a little bit more effective on average than everolimus. I should point out that a lot of people are starting cabozantinib also at 40 milligrams rather than the standard 60 milligrams because of tolerability issues. Also should mention there's a phase 3 studies starting now looking at cabozantinib versus zanzalitimab, which is another tyrosine kinase inhibitor that's supposedly more tolerable and potentially more effective. So we're very eager to find something that patients can really tolerate very, very well.
Any other trials or strategies being looked at in well-differentiated neck that you are excited about?
Yeah. So for well-differentiated NET, we're excited about alpha therapies. There's the ongoing phase 3 Action 1 study looking at 225 actinium dotatate versus a comparator, which could either be everolimus, sunitinib, or high-dose somatostatin analog in patients who have already received lutetium. And then another alpha emitter that's being studied is lead-212. And there's several lead-212 studies using different vectors. One is lead-dotumtate. There's another that's combined to something called VMT. These are showing pretty encouraging outcomes, both in PRRT-naive and refractory cases. There is an upcoming phase 3 study that's going to compare lead-212 dotumtate to lutetium in patients who have not yet received PRRT. So that would be a very interesting study because it lets us compare both efficacy and toxicity.
So one final question. I'm kind of curious how you ended up focused on these unusual cancers and led it to the career you've had and how you like it.
So it's actually an interesting story. So when I did my fellowship at Moffitt, I happened to work with Larry Coles, who you probably know. He was a really international expert in neuroendocrine cancers. He did the first studies with somatostatin analog octreotide back in the mid-1980s. So it was a fascinating clinic, very heterogeneous disease, ranging from, you know, really, really slow-growing cancers to really aggressive. And the treatment tends to be rather individualized, more for well-differentiated neuroendocrine tumors. I mean, poorly differentiated neuroendocrine tumors, unfortunately, there's not enough treatments really to individualize things. But for well-differentiated, it can get very complicated to know which treatment to choose, when to choose a particular therapy or versus just observe or continue current treatment, when to do systemic versus liver-directed therapy. So, and they're just so fascinating clinically. And there's obviously a lot of room for improving our treatments and doing research. So, you know, just a fascinating group of cancers and with, at least with well-differentiated neuroendocrine tumors, opportunity to, you know, treat patients sometimes for many years. And hopefully, you know, in the coming decades, we'll be able to say similar things about poorly differentiated neuroendocrine cancers.
In other uncommon cancers, I've seen advocacy groups take a major role in terms of trying to get research done. You know, in the past, it was really tough to try to figure out how you're going to do study on such uncommon diseases. Any advocacy groups that have been in the middle here?
Yeah, there are multiple advocacy groups for patients with well-differentiated neuroendocrine tumors or neuroendocrine cancers in general, but the large majority of patients have well-differentiated neuroendocrine tumors. There are national groups. There are local groups. There is a particularly prominent group from L.A. That used to be called LACNET. Now they've become national, and I forget their new name, but that's a really good group led by Lisa Yen. There's a group from San Francisco led by Josh Mailman, who's done a ton of advocacy over PRRT and really been instrumental in getting approval for new drugs to be studied. And you know, within Florida, we have our own advocacy group, FLANET. There is an advocacy group for poorly differentiated neuroendocrine cancers as well. So yeah, I'd say it's a pretty active environment.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to Dr. Strasberg, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Oncology Today.